For the week of May 27th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 149, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. Back in Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And still in New York, I'm Michael Gill.
You say still in New York like it's a punishment.
No, not at all. It's hot, but it's not a punishment.
Well, hopefully some of our entertainment news this week is just as hot.
Keep going.
Yes. Okay. So I don't know. Maybe it's the jet lag. My segues aren't as good as they usually are because, of course, we all know they're stellar.
And what are they?
What are what?
What are the stories that we're going to cover this week?
Well, on today's show, we're going to wrap up our coverage of this year's Cannes Film Festival with Ann Thompson from IndieWire and the Oscar Talk podcast. We'll tell you who won the festival's big awards this past Sunday and whether we agree with the jury's decision. The latest season of American Idol came to an end last week, though its declining ratings mean it is no longer the number one television show in America. Is that a laugh or is that a cry? I'm a little confused.
Right, keep going.
Okay, just wondering. Hey, you know, Apple has responded to the government's antitrust suit, you know, that whole thing about ebooks. And based on their rebuttal, I'm going to take a wild guess here that they're not all that happy with the Department of Justice. That's just my, you know, my take on it. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
All right. As always, we include box office figures from around the world. We add up the North American box office and box office from overseas. This week, it's a bit of a mixed bag because in North America, we had a four-day weekend. So we have grosses from Friday to Monday, Monday being Memorial Day, a holiday here in America. And we also have three-day weekend grosses from around the world, from the rest of the world. So it's a bit of a apples and oranges type thing. But basically, we're giving you the latest information we have about the total money earned by movies around the world. And using those figures, the number one movie around the world this holiday weekend is Men in Black 3, which grossed $202 million worldwide in its debut. It's Will Smith's first movie in 4 years. It proves he's still a draw, even for a fading franchise that people weren't very excited to hear about again. Here in North America, it opened to $70 million, which was immediately derided as a disappointment.
Yes. Now, I wonder, you say that it proves that Will Smith is a box office draw, but the reality is he made the first two films when he was at the top of his game and the top of his career. And I wonder, are people going to see Will Smith or are they going to see the third installment of this particular franchise, or is it a combination of both? I would imagine it's the latter, but I don't think it's Will Smith that's drawing people in here. Do you?
Of course it is. He's one of the biggest stars in the world, and he's always a bigger draw overseas, even going back to Bad Boys. He is almost all of his movies, including a lot of dramas and comedies, have grossed more money overseas than they have in North America. He's always been a big draw around the world, you know, even when he broke out. This movie is no different. It grossed $70 million in the U.S. and $130 million overseas. He is a big name. He hasn't made a movie in 4 years, but that year he had a drama, 7 Pounds, which didn't do very well. And he had an action film, Hancock, which grossed $600 million worldwide. If this movie ends up grossing $600 million, Sony will, you know, heave a sigh of relief and be very, very happy. So Will Smith is still a very big star.
Well, you know, the talk of Cannes was, I guess there was this incident in Moscow at the premiere for Men in Black 3, in which this journalist who is known for kissing movie stars and celebrities tried to kiss Will Smith, and Will Smith kind of just quietly decked him.
Okay, I heard nothing about that.
Yeah, no, it was the talk of Cannes for all of a day, and somebody asked, I can't remember who it was they asked about it, but they asked some celebrity, I want to say it was Kristen Stewart or what's the guy's name from Lawless?
Tom Hardy?
Tom Hardy, yes. Thank you.
There we go.
You know, I'm telling you, it's the jet lag.
Yeah. So and this man or this woman responded?
Yeah, no. I mean, you know, it was just one of those little, if you look it up on YouTube, you'll see a little.
I thought you said that people asked these celebrities about the incident.
Yeah, they did. And the celebrities turned around and went, what? Just they what?
That's your story?
That's my story. And I'm sticking to it.
That's the worst story ever. Well, I wouldn't want to be kissed by a stranger either. It's ridiculous. You know, people don't even like to shake hands anymore because of germs and disease. Though if you've seen Will Smith in 6 Degrees of Separation, you can see that he's not very good at kissing strangers anyway, even in character. The number two movie in the box office around the world is still The Avengers. $73 million worldwide after being on top for 4 weekends. Or is it 3 weekends? I think it's 4 weekends. It's now number two.
It's four weekends, yes.
Right.
And so I think 5 weekends overseas. I think it opened overseas first.
That's right. So it's dropped down from number one to number two. It's grossed $1.31 billion worldwide. It's poised to pass Harry Potter Part 7, Part 2 any minute now. It will become the number three film of all time. It set another record. It was the fastest to $500 million domestically. It set that in 23 days, which blasts the record set by Avatar, which reached $500 million in 32 days. So that's awfully impressive. These movies, though, everybody can see them as much as they want to right away. And so, again, it looks like, though, it's made as much money as you could hope for any movie to make, really. The idea of it reaching $202 billion is now seeming a fading memory. Number three around the world is Sacha Baron Cohen's comedy, The Dictator. That grossed $23 million worldwide. It's at $70 million and counting. And number four is the Johnny Depp film Dark Shadows, another $22 million worldwide. It's at $171 million and counting. And number five is the poor, forlorn Battleship. That grossed $16 million worldwide. It's at $270 million and counting, and is the latest example of Hollywood overspending on movies, and everybody wants to figure out what happened and what went wrong and avoid doing it in the future, but you can't. At number six, in a very strong expansion in North America, is The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, our friendly little film that senior citizens love all around the globe. It grossed $12 million worldwide. It's at $98 million and counting. In North America, it expanded to 1,200 screens, and it grossed $8 million, which is really a very strong average and a strong showing for a movie like this geared towards a more adult audience, the sort of people who don't rush out to the box office on the first weekend. So we're going to have to see if it has some legs in the U.S. I imagine it will, because it's done great all over the world, so why shouldn't it do well here?
And there's also a lot of news stories now about how this is a kind of sleeper hit. It's like my Big Fat Greek Wedding, where it kind of just sticks around for a long period of time and makes a ton of money.
Who said it's like my? It's been out for 4 weeks. It's not. My Big Fat Greek Wedding was in theaters for a year. This is not My Big Fat Greek Wedding. This is a very quick expansion on a film with big stars, big names for adults, Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, people from Downton Abbey, Tom Wilkinson. This is not, My Big Fat Greek Wedding with almost nobody in it except John Corbett.
I think they're more referring to it not from a star standpoint, but more from a business standpoint, that it's a small film.
But no, it's
film.
Not even close. It's not a small film. It's a big name film with big people. It's been in theaters for 4 weeks and it's already grossed $18 million. It's not a slow burning. It's nothing like My Big Fat Greek Wedding. Nothing whatsoever. That's just stupid. At number seven is What to Expect When You're Expecting, which grossed $12 million worldwide. It's at $35 million and counting. And number eight is a horror film, which tried to do a little counter-programming against Men in Black 3. Mm-hmm. Nobody's quite sure why they released a horror film on Memorial Day weekend, though I guess any time of the year is fine to be scared. It grossed $9 million and will probably fade very, very fast. And number nine, way down lower, is American Reunion, the American Pie film. That grossed another $3 million worldwide, $222 million and counting for that one. And at number 10, these are very rough estimates because we can't get great numbers on these movies in their box office in other countries. But The Hunger Games, which seems to have disappeared from most box office around the world, it grossed $2.8 million. It's at over $500 million, $526 million to be exact. But that's not the end of the story. Those are the top 10 films at the worldwide box office. But some of the biggest news came in limited releases.
That's right. I know you want to talk about Moonrise Kingdom, which premiered at Cannes, and it was the opening night film. And it broke all sorts of records over the weekend.
It did. It has the highest per screen average in history for a live action film.
Live action, we should say. That's not animated.
That's right. That's why I said live action film. It grossed $130,000 over the 3-day weekend on just 4 screens. Now, hey, it's the highest grossing ever for a live-action film. I think that's a fair thing to make. It beat Dreamgirls, which had the previous record of $125,000 per screen. Some people said dumb things like it has the highest per-screen average for a movie opening on 4 screens. It's like, well, 4 versus 3 versus 2 versus 5, who cares? But when you look into it, it ranks number 9 all-time in North America for the best per-screen average. Number 8 to 1. All animated films. Number one is The Lion King, which grossed $793,000 on just 2 screens. That's a hell of a per screen average.
That is,
That means they were charging high ticket prices, which is what they did with The Princess and the Frog just a few years ago. But then there are other, just even smaller films like Brother Bear, movies you've forgotten about, grossed more than Moonrise Kingdom on a per screen average. There was a period there when they would open animated films for like a week or two on just a very few screens, create a frenzy of excitement for them, get great reviews, and then go wide. So that era has sort of ended, though they did it again just recently with The Princess and the Frog. But that's why you see those massive numbers for those movies. Not that any movie couldn't do it. Any movie that had huge anticipation. If you opened The Avengers on two screens, God knows what you could charge for that movie. But they did it with animated films. And it's been a tradition, less so with the live action films. They tend to be sort of smaller art films or end of the year releases that come out in December and they expand in January. That's where you see movies like Platoon all the way back in the, I remember that movie back in the 80s opening very strongly. I think it was like 40,000 per screen. It was a high number at the time. And
well, I think or like Iron Lady did the same thing.
Sure. It wasn't on, how high was it on the list?
I don't know.
Right. It opened on a few screens and expands. It did not do tremendously well. It did fine, I'm sure. But so Moonrise Kingdom, a long tradition of, you know, big films, but this is by far the best showing for a Wes Anderson film. Obviously, it's very limited amounts, just four screens, two in New York, two in L.A. Whether this is going to indicate that this movie for some reason has a greater appeal than his other films, I don't think so. I'm not quite sure why this did so well. It got friendly reviews at Cannes, but people were not ecstatic over it.
No, and I mean, basically, he's got, I mean, this is Wes Anderson, the filmmaker that we're talking about here. He's got his fans and he's got his detractors, and usually they're split right down the middle. There's very few people who are like myself who go, eh, you know, I could take it or leave it. I'm not, I don't hate him. I don't love him. But the people who love him really love him. And so they're all out there the first weekend that they can be out there to see the movie. They are in the theater.
This is a huge, huge number.
Yes, it is.
And I'm not quite sure why. Life Aquatic didn't do this number. What was the Darjeeling Express? That didn't do this number.
Fantastic Mr. Fox probably didn't do this number either.
Probably did well. I'm not sure if it opened on just a few screens. But why this would suddenly pop for him, I'm not sure. We'll have to see if it indicates some bigger box office down the road for this movie.
Well, or do you think it's just that over time, Wes Anderson as a filmmaker has gathered so many fans that when he opens a movie now, it's his name rather than the stars or the story or all the publicity around it that is attracting audiences?
Oh, he's definitely a name brand. It doesn't matter, you know, whatever, but that doesn't explain why it's the highest grossing live action film of all time on a few screens, you know. The best per screen average in history. That's not explained by the fact that it's a Wes Anderson film. We do have a better indication for The Untouchables, though. That's the French comedy we've been talking about for quite a while. It's been a monster overseas. It has grossed $343 million worldwide. I saw it at a screening, and I can now tell you I don't know why. This is the movie about a quadriplegic. He's not a paraplegic. He's a quadriplegic who hires a new... Potentially, I think it's not even spelled out that he's an illegal immigrant, but he seems to be an illegal immigrant who's just a rough, regular Joe to help him take care of him and wheel him around. You know, he's tired of people pitying him. So this multi-millionaire hires this, you know, illegal immigrant from Africa to take care of him and treat him like a guy. So it's just the most banal sort of comedy where, you know, he takes the guy to the opera and the guy's like, this is stupid. They're just singing. You know, he hates opera, hates classical music, but he likes to dance and play pop music. And our hero, he wakes up the tired old white guy, and the tired old white guy helps him learn a little bit more about art and beauty. And it's just it's not that it's offensive, though it certainly can be if you have any sort of sense of race relations. It certainly could be taken at an offensive level. It's just so banal and boring that I'm puzzled as to why it did so well overseas. But now it's here in North America. It's on four screens, and by God, it's doing pretty well here. It looks poor compared to Moonrise Kingdom, but that's a bad comparison. Open on four screens to 25,000 per screen. That's a very solid debut. Word of mouth will probably be good here, just like it has been everywhere else. And this may turn into a word of mouth art house hit, just like The Exotic Marigold Hotel.
Well, you mean just like My Big Fat Greek Wedding, because this doesn't star anybody we know, and maybe it'll make $100 million like My Big Fat Greek Wedding, no?
Well, I suppose anything is possible. I doubt it, but if
I'm just trying to make, you know, trying to work My Big Fat Greek Wedding into this episode. Am I succeeding at all?
You've done it several times.
Okay, just check.
Another movie that did well in the North American box office that we should mention as far as a an indie release is Bernie, the Richard Linklater film starring Jack Black. I've heard a lot of good stories about this. It expanded to 194 screens. It also has doing quite well, getting good word of mouth. It grossed over $1 million. So that's a very solid showing for a very small film. And I've heard reports from friends who've said, oh, they quite liked it. So I guess I'll have to check it out.
Well, Michael, I may not be able to bring up My Big Fat Greek Wedding again, but if you look at The Untouchables, if you look at Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, they all have something in common. And that is they all star senior citizens, right?
True, and they're European films.
And over the weekend in Cannes, senior citizens won all the big prizes.
That's true.
And that voice you hear is Ann Thompson of the Thompson on Hollywood blog from IndieWire. She's joining us to tell us about the Cannes Film Festival. We were both there. Of course, her podcast, Oscar Talk, can be found just about everywhere, including on iTunes. Ann, thank you for joining us.
Oh, happy to be here.
Now, okay, so Amour, Michael Haneke's film, won the top prize, the Palme d'Or, at the Cannes Film Festival. Is this something you'd agree with?
Well, it was absolutely expected. I mean, it was the film that it was impossible to get into. It's the one film where I ended up at what they call the overflow screening room, the 60e, because even early in the morning, that Palais was packed. It was the Michael Haneke film that everyone was anticipating would be great. And guess what? It was.
Really?
It
because for me, I didn't know. I got into the Palais, which seats about 2,300 people. So when you say that it's packed and you have to go to an overflow screening room, that means, you know, close to 3,000 people are going to watch this film at the same time. Sure, he won the Palme d'Or in 2009 with The White Ribbon, but I didn't know anything about the film before it started showing.
Well, what's interesting about it is that it takes these iconic actors who've been missing from the screen, Emmanuel Riva, who, you know, was in Hiroshima Mon Amour, and Jean-Louis Trintignant from A Man and a Woman, and he hadn't worked for 14 years, and he came back for this movie, and he's, you know, glad he did. And they just give heartbreaking, realistic, naturalistic performances as two people, you know, nearing the end of their lives, caring for each other. She has a stroke at the beginning and he has to look after her, and he's not in such good shape himself. And then there's the daughter, Isabelle Huppert, who's playing a rather unpleasant, you know, character, and she rings all too true. I mean, all of us, everybody on the planet at some point or other has to deal with parents or themselves getting older and facing that good night. And this movie really deals with it in a very affecting way.
My dad is in rehab right now, so I'm definitely dealing with that after a colon cancer surgery, and he's got a bit of dementia. But I wonder, Haneke has such a stern, austere reputation. Is this movie somehow warmer than his usual? Is it really a punishing film where you look at senior citizens facing death?
It's not harsh at all. What do you think, Sperling?
I would say exactly that it's not harsh at all, that it is very almost endearing and loving and touching. It's soft in a way.
So it's very unusual for Haneke.
Yes.
It's clear-eyed. That's what I would say. It's not gussied up. It has a deceptive simplicity. That's what's so brilliant about it. It just shows you this stuff. And it's very spare and austere the way he is. But that's about editing. That's about being clear about what he's trying to accomplish. It isn't hard to sit through at all. You care about these people, and you love them, and they love each other. It's very moving.
Well, and the whole thing could have taken place on stage, because really it takes place in one apartment. That's it.
And it's never dull. I mean, because they're up against real issues. You know, if he comes home and she's lying on the floor, that's an issue.
Right. Now, yeah. I mean, Haneke won, as I mentioned, the Palme d'Or in 2009. It's very rare for a filmmaker to win more than one Palme.
And so it's a back-to-back situation as well. I mean, Francis Coppola and
the Dardenne brothers.
Yep. There's a short list, a very short list.
Billy August. So it was a popular choice. I don't think either of you was there for the actual ceremony, but I believe it got a very strong, sustained standing ovation, more than usual, when it was announced. The runner-up, however, was a lot more controversial. The Grand Prix winner was Reality, a film by the director of Gomorrah, a gangster movie I really liked. This is about a fisherman in Italy who wants to be in the local version of Big Brother. He's just obsessed with this. And this was a far more divisive choice than Amour turned out to be. Did either of you see that Reality, or what's your impression of it?
I did not see it, partly because so many people disliked it. I shouldn't have allowed that to happen. But, you know, you do have to make certain choices. And I liked Gomorrah, but the critical response. Now, that doesn't have anything to do with what the jury is going to do, by the way. They don't always match up, although with the Moore, it did. A lot of people wondered if the fact that Nanni Moretti was the president of the jury and an Italian might not have had some impact on this.
I think that might actually be the case, because this was a film that nobody thought was going to win anything. People had written this film off because it was okay, but not great. And frankly, it was very forgettable. And yet at the awards ceremony, the fact that it wins second place, that it's the runner-up over a film like Beyond the Hills, is just shocking. And so that's why you probably heard a lot of booing when he was his name was mentioned, and the director is escaping me.
Matteo Garrone.
Yes, thank you.
So, but the Munju did win two prizes: the screenplay, and the directing. Right? What was the second?
No, screenplay and actress.
The acting,
they shared
the
best
two
actress.
Actors. Right.
Christina Fluter and Cosmina Stratton. And the Romanian director Cristian Mungiu won for Beyond the Hills, a Romanian film about two girls who were childhood best friends. And then as they came older and came back together, they were sort of split apart a bit by one girl's deep attachment to life in a monastery and her Orthodox faith.
I really loved this film. And I have an interview with him, which I'm about to post. And I loved meeting him because he's the real thing. He's a pure artist. And there aren't that many of them in this world. And he shoots these long, uninterrupted takes, and he gets these extraordinary performances out of these non-professionals, and digs into some serious issues about people, you know, who can be incredibly stupid when they believe in the tenets of a religion. You know, it's a pretty tough movie. I loved it.
It is a tough movie, and I think it's purposefully tough. And a lot of people complained, oh, it's too long. But you know what? I agree with you, Anne. It was a great movie. And it was one of those movies that stuck with you, much like Amour. These are movies that people were debating 3, 4, 5 days later at the festival. People kept talking about them as they sat down for other screenings, which to me is the mark of a film that, you know, a good film.
But it is unusual that they would go with these two non-pro girls, you know, as the actresses, the best actresses, over, say, Marion Cotillard and Jacques Audiard film Rust and Bone, which I also liked, which won nothing. That's one of those cases, sort of like Le Havre, where the only thing it could have won was the Palme d'Or.
That's right.
And they weren't going to let it have, you know, it's sort of one of those all or nothing things. But I was surprised by that, and they didn't go with Emmanuel Riva either. And so the president of the jury went out of his way, Nanni Moretti, to you know, express how important Trintignant and Riva were to the film Amour, even if they didn't
anything. And they were brought up on stage by Michael Haneke, So that was a very nice gesture as well. And of course, with Beyond the Hills, you can see that it's yet another example of Romanian cinema being so ripe and rich right now. They're just one terrific movie after another. Best director was also perhaps a little controversial, just like the runner-up prize. That was Carlos Regadas for Post Tenebras Lux. He's the sort of director that lives for a festival like Cannes, because this is the world where he gets celebrated and talked about, whereas at the box office, he's barely figures at all.
I was going to say, and then he completely disappears because his films are difficult at best.
I skipped this one, too, I have to say. So based on what everybody told me, and I liked Hapon very much, and I'll try to catch up with this later and see what all the fuss was about.
It's a very stark, and well, you know what, you'll see it when it's not a very commercial film at all. It's got no story,
but that's what Cannes lives for, right? That's
exactly
the place where we can talk about. You just think it's not a good film either, though, right, Sperling?
I did not like it, and there were several others that other Americans that did.
Right, well, we don't care if it's commercial or not, but we don't think it's necessarily a movie that people are going to be talking about at the end of the year. Best actor, perhaps.
In fact, there were very few films in this festival that will be talked about at the end of the year. That's one of the interesting things about it.
Well, I mean, let's talk about that for a second, because Michael and I kind of had a little bit of a debate last week about the fact that Cannes sometimes feeds the Oscars, at least in the acting categories. And looking at a movie like Amour, which won the Palme, I look at that and say, hey, this is a film that could be nominated for, forget about Best Foreign Language Feature, it could be nominated for Best Film.
Well, that virtue never happens. But if you look at a major star like Jean-Louis Trintignant, who is a major figure in cinema, you know, he and the female lead for Best Actor and Actress, they seem like they could be potentials if you have the right campaign pushing them. It's a career award. It's touching. It's moving. It is the sort of film that perhaps could garner an acting nomination for a person in a foreign language film.
It will be submitted by Austria, according to Sony Pictures Classics. I'm talking about
foreign language
film, Amour, even if it's in French. And I wonder, I mean, the Sony Pictures Classics people have it in mind. They're going to push for it. They're going to go for everything they can get, of course. And it's a possibility. It just depends on what the competition is at the end of the year and whether all the critics, you know, fall in line and give it absolutely every shot. If it, you know, if you start seeing the Golden Globes and the other groups, you know, the critics groups lining up to give them prizes, and it becomes, you know, a foregone conclusion, then it will happen. But it needs that kind of attention.
Well, it looks like the big winners, according to the IndieWire critics poll, there were 5 movies that garnered a B+ average or better. And they are Amour, which we've talked about, Holy Motors, a crazy film, Moonrise Kingdom, the Wes Anderson movie, probably one of the best reviewed opening night films in history, Beasts of the Southern Wild, which is an American indie film, and No, the Gael Garcia Bernal film. Those seem to be, from your poll at IndieWire, to be the movies that got the most critical consensus. Does that work with you, Anne, as well as, of course, Beyond the Hills?
Absolutely, absolutely. I would add, I saw No at the first screening at the director's fortnight, and it got this rousing standing ovation. Now, in the director's fortnight, if the real audience gets up and applauds and cheers and stands on their chairs, that's real. Like, if you're in the Palais and you're doing one of the galas, you know, with one of the competition films, and they're all applauding.
They always applaud. They always
stand up. It's fake. On some level, it's orchestrated. You can't really measure that so well. But in the director's fortnight, that was genuine. And that movie got picked up by Sony Pictures Classics because I think it's going to be submitted by Chile. As therefore, they like to grab all the foreign films, you know, that they can, and they also have Rust and Bone. I love that film. That it's about an ad executive, sort of like a Mad Men kind of thing, set in 88, and he's this is Gael Garcia Bernal, and a very moving and good performance. He's in danger. The group of people that are mounting this campaign, the No campaign, to throw Pinochet out, to defeat him in the elections. And they're in danger. It's a good movie.
Well, let me ask you this: The Camera Door, which it goes to a best time. Listen to me,
first
time feature filmmaker. And there's, you know, 20-25 films that are up for this award across all the sidebars, like the director's fortnight, and No did win the director's fortnight, and you know, the En Sortant Regard and the Critics Week. Beast of the Southern Wild by Ben Zeitlin. This is the film that won the Sundance Film Festival about a little girl who's named Hush Puppy. And it's kind of, you know, down in the deep South Bayou, and it's the end of the world. And it won the Camera Door. Is this something that you would is that a decision you agree with? Is this a film you like?
I love Beasts of the Southern Wild. It was a huge, huge discovery at Sundance. And Ben Zeitlin is the real deal, although he likes to say that he's part of a collective of filmmakers who make films in a certain kind of collaborative, discovering kind of way. I thought it might win the Camera Door. So I was watching the show on my computer here in Los Angeles, the closing night, the Cérémonie de Clôture. And I was like, oh, I was so rooting for it to win. I was like being a real rah-rah American. And I was very, very glad that it did. That's a movie that a lot of people thought should have been in the competition. Why was it placed in Un Certain Regard? Because it was at Sundance. These are the politics. Even though Sex, Lies, and Videotape once managed to overcome that and win the Palme d'Or back in the day, but very rare that they will put a Sundance movie in the competition. And I think that the Searchlight people are going to push that one all the way through very successfully to the Oscars. I'm counting on it.
Well, stepping back and looking at it overall, Anne, the story that Sperling walked away with last week was that Cannes was very expensive, and a lot of journalists were sort of going, wow, you know, it's gotten more and more expensive. I'm not sure I can justify it. What was the temperature that you felt overall for journalists coming from the U.S. to Cannes and the expense of it and how they were thinking about the festival and so on?
Well, everybody really found first of all, there was this large group of movies that basically disappointed, you know? I mean, and you could sort of see it going in. I mean, it wasn't a huge shock that they were that on the, you know, I really liked On the Road. Actually, I admired it very much, but these are films that did not win prizes, you know? So you have Lawless and you have Killing Them Softly and there was a lot of star power. So the journalists who were chasing after interviews, some of them couldn't get them, because the foreign press eats up most of the time, and I don't think there was really a big crop of winning commercial accessible movies that are going to travel back to the States, you know, in a big way.
There rarely are, though, are there? I mean, that's not usually what happens at Cannes.
It happens that something like The Artist goes back and becomes a big phenomenon, and people get big jump on their coverage that way. But you know, I have to say that I did like The Hunt, and I did like Sightseers. That's Ben Wheatley's movie that was in the fortnight. He's a British filmmaker, very funny. But the list of movies that were and The Hunt was good. The Mads Mikkelsen won Best Actor for the Thomas Vinterberg.
I'm glad to hear you say that because, you know, I liked that film, and most of the Americans I spoke with, this is the film about a falsely accused teacher. He's falsely accused of sexual molestation of a kindergartner. And I liked it. Most of the Americans did not. They hated it. And I didn't see what was there to hate.
I think what happens is that as the movie unfolds, it's so familiar, the idea of a teacher being accused of molesting a student. You know, it feels like a TV movie to people that has the, you know, I mean, it turns into something else. It turns about an innocent man and how he handles, you know, being utterly ostracized and victimized when he has done nothing wrong. That's what the movie's really about. And the last half of it is, you know, just so interesting, and I shouldn't use that word. That's a word I'm not allowed to use. It's compelling and it's disturbing, and his performance makes the film worth seeing.
Mads Mikkelsen, yeah.
No one's picked that one up, by the way. And there's a reason, because they think no one's going to want to see it.
You know, I talked to a couple Danish journalists about this and said, well, how Danish is this film? It's made by Thomas Vinterberg. It's a Danish film, you know, it's in Danish. And they said, look, it really is. There's a lot of subtext that's very Danish, and the cultural overtones are very apparent in the film because, you know, asking these journalists what the film is about, they said it's about a person, yes, falsely accused, but it's also about how he becomes a man. How he wasn't a man before. He wasn't considered a man.
He was very mild-mannered, very, very passive, very reactive.
Right.
And he finally acts back.
That's
right.
One other big story from last week was the information on what people are sometimes charged in order to get an interview. Which is usually a burden shouldered by the producers of a movie or the people in different territories who want to get press on it. But now there was an offer made out to journalists. Hey, you want to interview these people? Pay me $500. Have you ever been asked to pay for an interview, Anne?
Never.
Have you heard of that being done?
I'm shocked. I've never even shocked.
There's gambling. Yes.
I did not know that.
I don't know if that's,
at Cannes,
is that
journalists
true?
Were being asked to pay ever. I did not know that from any territory.
I can't imagine that that's true. Really.
No, actually, it was true of Canada, and that's because Alliance Atlantis didn't want to pay for the Canadian journalists to have a junket for, I believe it was On the Road and Killing Them Softly. So they said, look, if you want it, you can have it, but you're going to have to pay for it yourself. I mean, that was kind of a big news story at the outset of the festival, and it kind of died down over time. Toward the end of the festival, it was more about the parties, Amphar. And do you go to this Kanye West screening of Cruel Summer, the 7 screens, a 26-minute film on 7 different screens? He has to do everything large. He can't do something small. Last year,
I have to say, the concert where Kanye West performed on the beach with Leonardo DiCaprio in the audience was one of the best concerts I've ever been to. It was just extraordinary. And I decided I didn't, you know, you have X amount of time. How much of your time are you going to spend chasing after something? You know, you have to really, line up Amphar, for example. That's the other thing I didn't go to this year. I used to go, but I've been so many times And it's a big, you know, auction, and Harvey's there, and everything is about, you know, people trying to give money, and it's a good thing, but it's a big celebrity fashion fest. And I just, that's not what I'm there for anymore. I don't have to do those things. I'm there to see the films and write about the films and interview people.
And is that what keeps bringing you back? I mean, why do you keep going to Cannes? Because it is expensive, and sometimes, as Michael said, the cost, you know, it's not justified. What is it about the films that keeps bringing you back?
Well, I think the trade publications do go in force, and IndieWire is in that realm of, you know, getting original content, getting new stories, you know, reviewing the films, finding out what the Oscar story is part of what has to happen there, and getting a lead on some of the big films that are going to come back to the States. As a film critic, I need to see the films. You know, there are films that I will see there that I won't see anywhere else, but it's really... For Variety or the trades, and IndieWire is part of that. That's our mission, is to transmit all that information back, you know, to people who can't be there.
It seems harder to justify if you're, say, the Minneapolis Star Tribune or the Chicago Sun-Times. I don't know how you can justify it there as much anymore, even though if you love movies, you want to be there. But if you, as a film lover, go there and in 10 days you see two movies, three movies that are going to be on your best of the year list, that seems like a pretty good 10 days of movie going.
Well, so the Chicago Sun-Times sends a woman named Barbara Sharris, who's a top programmer there in Chicago, and she doesn't get paid anything. She writes one story a day for Roger Ebert's column, and you know, she's paid by her outfit to go, and then you know, the Sun-Times gets her for free, in effect. There's no cost to them.
That's the new world of journalism.
Well, now, how would you compare this year's festival? And I know it's kind of unfair to compare year to year, but how was this year's festival in comparison to some of the festivals in Cannes that you've been to in the past?
This was a weak festival. There's no question about it. And I understand that Terry Frimaud, the director, knew going in that this was a weak festival. And he was basically picking the best that was offered to him that he could get. And I think they got, as you say, they got a great opening night movie, Moonrise Kingdom. And the other good thing about that is that you have a release paradigm that's successful, that, you know, Midnight in Paris did the same thing, where they opened and then they went right into release all over the place. And Moonrise Kingdom is following that playbook and is doing really well. And then even if they didn't win anything, it was too light. It was too much. Even if it was in competition, it was too light for that sort of grim group on that jury to give it anything.
Well, a light film did win. The Angel Share won the jury prize. This is Ken Loach's comedy. And I love that film. It was a lot of fun. Did you see the film?
I did not.
Oh, wow. Okay. It's worth seeing.
I like his films. Yeah. So I'll catch up with that.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree it was kind of weak, but I also agree. I mean, Frimaud was kind of put in a hard spot here because, you know, the usual suspects weren't around. So you had Quentin Tarantino, his film will be done in December. Terrence Malick too, his film's not done yet. So all of these films weren't ready yet.
And the Weinstein Company, which sort of disappointed with Lawless and Killing Them Softly, put on a show and tell for the press with three films, including the Tarantino, but also Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master and David O. Russell's Silver Linings Playlist. So these are the films that are actually going to emerge later on, probably, in the Oscar race that weren't ready for Cannes.
Well, the Marché was up in attendance 8%. I mean, do you feel it was more crowded?
Oh, the Marché was successful. The Marché had more buys, more sells, more stuff going on than they have in a long time. I mean, it's coming out of the recession, although I hear that people are worried about the state of the euro, European Union, and all the problems that are coming there. That could have a terrible impact on the film industry if it becomes dire.
But I mean, was the festival more crowded than it usually is, or was it about the same?
I honestly can't say for, you know, definitively that it was less or more. And what do we have? We need the real attendance numbers.
I guess you're right about that. Yeah. I mean, there's not much you can say. I mean, but would you be going back next year? Is this,
of course.
I go to Cannes every year. Yeah. As long as I can afford to do it, I will do it.
Yeah. It's something, for me, it's like Christmas. You have to go.
I love it.
Yeah. No. And hopefully, I know that Michael missed this year, but, I personally look forward to having him back there next year. But in the meantime, Ann, thank you for joining us to give us your take on Can. It's always a welcome. And you can be followed on Twitter. AK Stanwyck is your username. And of course, your blog, Thompson on Hollywood, can be found on IndieWire. As can, I believe, Oscar Talk now. Is that correct?
Oscar Talk is over at In Contention. I mean, my blog has it too. I mean, Oscar Talk is on Thompson on Hollywood and In Contention. It goes up at the same time each week when we do it.
And of course, can also be downloaded on any of your favorite podcast aggregators, including iTunes. Anne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon.
Well, so now I feel even more sad that I missed Con. Is, you know, no matter what it's like, even if it's disappointing, if you see three movies and they're the three of the best films of the year, to me, that's a good festival. I always end up seeing two or three or four movies that make my list. I'm sure that Amour and Beasts of the Southern Wild, a Sundance film, and No, and a couple others will probably be in contention for my best of the year list. So if I'd seen those in that 10 days, I would have been very happy.
Well, but you were back here in the United States, and you were able, because I know you're a big American Idol fan. I know you.
I have been, yes. It's, you know, the bloom is off the rose after 11 seasons. But yes, for a change, I wasn't up at, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 in the morning watching it online or on a DVR in Cannes in a shaky streaming video presentation. I was able to actually watch it. Well, I didn't even actually watch it live because I was traveling to help see my dad. But yes, the American Idol finale happened. Phillip Phillips won, the fifth man in a row. 7 out of the 11 winners have been men. Men are just dominating this series right now. I guess a lot of women watch the show and they like to vote for their cute guy that they like the best of all. That's why we've seen David Cook and Chris Allen and Lee DeWise and Scott McCreery and now Phillip Phillips win the top prize. So that's been the story on Idol. But the biggest news is the ratings.
That's true. 19 million people watched it, but it wasn't enough to be the number one show in the country because it was topped by Sunday Night Football, which airs in the fall, of course, when football is played. 20.7 million viewers on average. So it was just edged out by football.
Well, it was almost number three. It only beat out NCIS, the long-running CBS drama starring Mark Harmon, by slightly over 300,000 viewers. If there had been another 6 or 7 weeks in the season, NCIS would have beaten it because it was pulling in more and closing that gap every week that there was a new episode of NCIS. So that was a nail-breaker. So after 7 years as the number one show in the country, no show has ever done that before in North America, American Idol is now the number two show in the country. We almost had our number one show in the country drawing less than 20 million people. That would have been the first time in history. Football was just over 20 million viewers. And this is the first time in history also that a sports program has been the number one show, the number one regularly scheduled show on a major network. Obviously, like a single events like the Super Bowl or the World Series or the Olympics, you know, are number one in the ratings. But even since the 50s, we've had regularly scheduled sports in prime time. We've had boxing and wrestling especially were very popular in the 50s. And we've had baseball in primetime scheduled as a regular weekly TV series. None of them have ever been the number one show in the country. Now, for the first time, it's football. So that's a massive change in the guard as well. When you talk about hundreds of channels and tons of good programming fragmenting the audience, something like football, a big sporting event, can still bring people together.
Well, if you look at the top 10 shows in the U.S. right now, I would say 8 out of 10 of them are reality shows, you know, except for 8, The Big Bang Theory, in at 8, and 7, NCIS Los Angeles. And I guess number 3, I apologize, NCIS. You know, those are all, everything else is Dancing with the Stars or The Voice or, you know,
American Idol.
Yeah, American Idol.
Well, I wouldn't call sports a reality show, but yeah, sports, you know, Sunday Night Football and the pregame show both ranked in the top 10.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
And then another 5 shows, American Idol, 2 nights of the week, Dancing with the Stars, 2 nights of the week, and The Voice are all in the top 10. So that's a lot of reality television. The pendulum will swing. Those will fall back down a bit. We've got Idol and The Voice. And in the top 20, you've got The X Factor and Survivor. And I think that's it for reality. But The X Factor was number 19 and 20. So even though Simon Cowell hyped it up a lot, you know, having a new show in the top 20 and in the top 10 on the demos that advertisers care about the most, that's the X Factor performance show. That's a great start for that series, and we'll have to see how they do you know, in the fall when they face off against The Voice.
Well, and there's been a lot of chatter about why is 2.5 Men with Ashton Kutcher still on the air, and here's why. It's number 11 with an average of 14.64 million people watching it each week. That's why it's still on the air, because it's still pulling huge numbers.
Who was asking why it was still on the air? In fact, it increased its total viewers and its demos in the 18 to 49 by a big chunk, by 15% in total viewers. It was up. A lot of that was due to the tune-in in the first few weeks, but still they maintained their edge over the season, and it's up 30% in 18 to 49-year-olds. So clearly, you know, it's still a profitable show, and still, despite the cost of paying for Ashton Kutcher and all those stars who've been on there a long time, it's making money and drawing the ratings. It's the number two sitcom in the country, with Big Bang Theory being number one.
Well, we talked a little bit about reality shows. Certainly, we just talked about some sitcoms, but dramas seem to have been gone missing, at least from the 10 o'clock hour.
That's right. NCIS and NCIS LA are the big stars of drama. After them, you go down to The Mentalist, which has been a fourth season, I guess, on CBS. That's doing quite well. That's getting moved to a new night. The biggest new drama hit is Person of Interest, also on CBS. That was on Thursday nights last season. That is the biggest new drama. After that, you have to go down to Once Upon a Time on ABC, a top 30 show, which did really well, top 20 in the demos that matter. That's proven a really good hit on Sunday night for ABC, a really unexpected success story. I didn't think it would do that well, and that's done really well. But if you look at the 10 p.m. hour, where primetime dramas used to rule, ER, of course, was a monster hit in L.A. Law, and so, and you know, NYPD Blue, so many other big hits. When you look at the 10 p.m. hour, the dramas are just not there. They're not scoring hits. They're not there at all. So Hawaii 5-0 is ranked number 41. And even if people are watching at 10 p.m., they're old people, which apparently advertisers don't care about. And you can see that with like Tom Selleck's show Blue Bloods. That's on Friday nights at 10 o'clock. Is it 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock? It's at 10 o'clock on Friday nights.
Yeah.
And it's ranked number 22. Good for Tom Selleck, 12 million viewers. But it's ranked number 97 in the 18 to 49 demo, because the average age of the people watching Blue Bloods is in fact 62 years old, despite the fact that my friend Nanette watches it. She loves it. She's in her 40s. But not enough of people like Nanette to make that show a hit in the 18 to 49 demo. So everyone watching dramas at 10 p.m. are pretty old. And there hasn't been a 10 p.m. drama finished in the top 10 in that demo since Lost back in 2006. So that's 6 years ago. So this has been a top 10 hit in the demo that advertisers care about. That's a 10 p.m. drama. So that's kind of amazing.
Well, and we have a story here about Cougar Town. And this was the show that was canceled and is going to be picked up, what, by TBS, I think?
That's right.
So, and it was on ABC, and it looks like they are now the third show, the third series, to get a new showrunner. Last week we talked about Community. This week it's going to be Cougar Town.
And before that was
Smash. Yes.
Right. So I was wrong. They got a 15-episode order. I thought they were getting a 30-episode order to bring it right up to 100. But they've ordered 15 episodes for the fourth season of Cougar Town. That takes us up to like 85 episodes, around there. And I imagine if it succeeds, they'll have a final season and get another 15 and take it up to 100. But yeah, they renewed the show. They brought it back and they got rid of the showrunner. And this sounds like the same story that we had with Smash and Community, but it's not quite the same. The co-creator, Bill Lawrence, had already inked a long-term deal with Warner Brothers Television. They signed him up. They want to be in the Bill Lawrence business. And so he was already scheduled to step down from day-to-day on Cougar Town after the third season, no matter what happened. So whether it was canceled or came back, he was not going to be the showrunner on that series, because he was moving over to a new deal with Warner Brothers and going to be launching new stuff. So that's why he's gone from the show. It's not a sense of like the other shows where we felt like they're being not fair to the creative talent involved or being short-sighted, however you want to view it. This is just an example of him signing a deal with another studio and having to step down from day to day. Personally, I feel like you shouldn't sign a new deal. You got a show on the air. You're lucky enough to have a hit series. To my mind, that's a full-time job. I don't like it when people try to launch two or three or four series while doing one show. He was going to step aside from day to day. My attitude is, why? If you've got a show on the air for three seasons, you've got a chance to, you know, take it to that magical run, take it through all the way and make it as good as possible. Why would you want to do another show? But money talks.
So then it's not a big deal that he stepped aside.
No, it's not, because he was going to do that anyway. It wasn't that TBS dumped him. So I would say it's a big whoop.
Oh, okay. Well, then it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the primetime lineup, since we're talking about ratings here, over on CNN, that primetime lineup hit a 20-year low recently, averaging just 395,000 viewers per hour. CNN is currently airing two shows, Anderson Cooper, Pierce Morgan, and then another hour of Cooper at 10 p.m. Even in a news channel's target demo of that 25 to 54-year-olds, it's faring poorly with no upside in sight as it struggles behind Fox News and MSNBC. Big deal or big whoop, Michael? Or should we just move on because it's a big deal?
It's a big deal. There's no other way to paint that. That's just horrible, horrible numbers for the channel that invented 24-hour news. This is just a sad case. Maybe Anderson Cooper should come out. Maybe Piers Morgan should go back to America's Got Talent. They need to do something.
Right. And the interesting thing for me is that whenever there's a big news story, you know, like a big world event, where do we turn? We all mostly turn to CNN.
Well, Fox has beaten that at some point, so it's not always true even today because Fox has been number one for a long time, day in and day out. But yes, CNN definitely draws people when there is a big live news event happening. They definitely get a big boost in the ratings, and they often have beaten Fox News in the past. I don't know if that's still true, and it's certainly not going to be true for long, not with Fox News being that far ahead all the time.
One of the biggest movie stars in the world for several decades, actor Jackie Chan insists his latest movie, Chinese Zodiac, will be his last action film.
No!
He's not retiring from movies. Chan still plans on making comedies and dramas, but he insists this is the end for full-fledged action because the toll on his 58-year-old body is just way too much. Unlike most action stars in the West, Chan really has done most, if not all, of his own stunts, making him more akin to, say, Buster Keaton and other silent film stars than a Hollywood actor who steps aside and lets a stuntman take all the risks. Chan wrote, directed, produced, and stars in Chinese Zodiac and took extra care with this film because he knew it would be his last action flick and wanted his fans to see it as special. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, if you're one of the couple billion people who live in Asia, it's a very big deal. Jackie Chan is a big star, and it's kind of sad to see him hanging up the whip, I guess, or if you were thinking of Indiana Jones, or he doesn't have any sort of trademark apparel or iconic thing, but to see him stepping away from action films after all these years, he's obviously been edging out of them slowly, you know, doing fewer and fewer of them or mixing in more comedies, not doing the stunts he used to do when he was a younger man. Still, to see him say goodbye to it is kind of sad.
You know, America loves the Red Room of Pain. The mommy porn, I knew you'd laugh at that. The mommy porn trilogy of books dubbed 50 Shades has taken off. Publisher Vintage says the trilogy of books 50 Shades of Grey, 50 Shades Darker, and 50 Shades Free has reached 10 million copies in all its incarnations, with the summer book selling season just getting into full swing. Film rights, of course, we talked about that in the past. They were sold for $5 million, with the author E.L. James reserving script and cast approval. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal, not just because it's a, you know, a hit series of books, but because of what it shows. I don't have good figures for how many it sold as, well, it wouldn't sell as fan fiction, of course, which is where it started on a Twilight fan fiction website. Then it was an ebook only from a small publisher or self-published. I don't have figures for how many it sold before that, before it was picked up by Vintage. But from everything I can gather, it was not very much. So what happened was you had a success story. You had a book that had a story that it could sell, you know, a little success to build on. But it took a Vintage publisher, Vintage, a regular publisher, and a big story in the New York Times talking about its success as mommy porn. That's what, you know, skyrocketed into millions and millions of sales. So even with, you know, people talking about self-publishing and e-reading and fan fiction websites, still helps to have a traditional publisher and attention in mass media to set your book, you know, soaring into the stratosphere. And the other thing that's interesting about this is that because people have e-readers and people don't know what you're reading on the subway or when you're at the supermarket or wherever you're reading at lunch, they don't know the book you're holding in your hand because it's an e-reader, so they can't see the title. That's allowing people apparently to read embarrassing books. I put that in quotes, books like erotica, like 50 Shades, and a lot of more adults are reading young adult novels like Harry Potter. They're not embarrassed to keep buying more of these books because people don't know what they're reading. They don't see the erotic cover or they don't see the cartoonish image of a young adult novel, or they don't see, you know, a steamy romance cover. And that helps them, that people speculate that this is adding to the allure of these books that people like to read. And now the embarrassment factor is gone.
Yeah. The flip side of that, of course, is that, you know, that used to be a way to market a book was, you know, having people read it in public and others would see.
Right. I think e-readers, and I've thought this for a while, I think e-readers should offer an option to transmit what book you're reading. So if there are other people with the same e-reader, like a Kindle, in the area, and they want to, if you want to show them what book you're reading, they could just get a flash saying in your vicinity, and, you know, you could turn it on or off. In your vicinity, someone's reading this, someone's reading this, someone's reading this. I think that'd be a fun little, you know, optional thing to offer.
Privacy advocates would love that, I'm sure.
But that's, privacy advocates should have no problem with that. It's an option you turn on and off at your own choice if you want to display to people what you're reading. There's no problem with privacy in that. Well, what's the problem? Well, as long as you opt in and decide when and where to do it, who cares?
No, I'm saying privacy advocates would have a field day.
Why would a privacy advocate object to that? As long as you have control over it and you decide whether you want to turn it on at all or ever, it's in your power. Why would they object to that?
Well, why is Congress and why are all these privacy advocates, you know, up in arms about Google or Facebook, all things that you can turn off? And yet they're still up in arms about it. So, you know, when people want to get up in arms about something, it doesn't matter whether you can opt in or turn it off. They'll be upset about it. There's nothing you can do. I hope not too many people are upset that they won't be able to see G.I. Joe this year, because in an unusual move just weeks before it was scheduled to open, Paramount is bumping its tentpole movie, G.I. Joe Retaliation. I feel like I had to. Well, they're bumping it from June 29th, 2012 to March 29th, 2013. At least they kept the 29 the same. Maybe they can just scratch out June and write in March. I don't know. Some suggest the stink of Hasbro's other toy movie, Battleship, scared the studio, and they want to put some distance between G.I. Joe and that other flop. Paramount says they need 3D. They absolutely need it in order to make their money back, and they want to do the 3D right. So they're holding off release to the less hectic time of March. G.I. Joe had the June 29th release date all to itself as far as action flicks were concerned, with its main competition being the stripper movie Magic Mike. Is that a stripper movie? I guess it is.
Yeah, it's the one with Channing Tatum as a stripper.
Oh, that's true, yeah. Out 1 week earlier were Pixar's Brave and Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. Opening 1 week later, The Amazing Spider-Man and Oliver Stone's crime flick Savages. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. March of 2013 doesn't look exactly easy. 1 week before it's scheduled to open, there's the latest Percy Jackson movie and a remake of Carrie. That's 2 weeks before. Then 1 week before is Jack the Giant Killer, which is going to be a very big property. And then the week it comes out right now when it's scheduled includes the Stephanie Meyer's flick The Host. She's the author of the Twilight series. And who knows how big that movie would be. But I want Sperling to knock a hole in this idea that they need 3D in order to make their money back. That to me just sounded ridiculous.
No, that's completely false. And the reality here is that, you know, they've moved this film a couple of times. It's probably not as good as they had hoped. And they would like to move it to a less competitive release window. That's really all they're doing.
But now Paramount has only one summer movie coming out, and it's a Katy Perry concert film due out in July. That is sad. They're sitting out the entire summer movie season.
Yeah, well, you know, hopefully they'll have more films in the fall and into the holiday season. Now, we told you it would happen. The satellite TV provider Dish introduced a new commercial skipping technology called AutoHop that allows people to skip all the commercials on a primetime major network TV show automatically. If they wait till 1 a.m. the day after it airs to begin watching it, it'll just skip over all the commercials. Now, Fox announced it was suing Dish. NBC announced, guess what they're doing? They're suing Dish. And CBS, they're taking a different approach. They're suing Dish. ABC was apparently out to lunch talking with its lawyers when Dish announced it was suing everyone else so the courts can decide the legality of this new service. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I think it's going to have to be resolved in the courts. But I think if you look at the history, the courts never ruled that VCRs were illegal or remote controls or the ability to skip over commercials that we have right now by going by fast forwarding. So I can't imagine how they could possibly rule that this is somehow illegal when all those other examples are not.
You know, the only thing they could say is it's one thing for a human being to activate something and to press fast forward or to use a remote control to change a channel. It's another thing for technology to take money out of somebody else's pocket. But you know what? I agree with you. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to say it's illegal.
When you allow your shows to be seen on DVR or downloaded, without commercials or streamed with lesser commercials the next day, that you could suddenly argue that somebody else has no right to do that either is seems pushing it.
Okay. Well, you know, I was surprised that you wanted to talk about this next story. Eurovision crowned another Europop winner with a dull tune called Euphoria, winning all of it, winning the big show for Sweden in a walk. As usual, block voting assured lots of tiny Eastern European countries were in the top tier, though Germany, Italy, and Spain had very strong showings. The UK continued its moribund performance, ranking second to last with Engelbert Humperdinck's Love Will Set You Free, although I would imagine Engelbert Humperdinck was not singing it.
He was singing it. He was the performer. No, he didn't write it. He just sang it. In fact, he sang it very poorly, and I was kind of excited. Like, Tom Jones, that's his name. Yeah, he still has a great voice. And I thought, oh, wow. And I watched the video of Engelbert Humperdinck thinking, you know, he'd be an old veteran. He sounded terrible. Like there was, okay. I can't imagine why he was doing it. It was ridiculous.
Well, maybe they were hoping people wouldn't realize Humperdinck was representing the UK. I don't know. But the crazy thing, only one Eurovision winner of the night was the second place entry called Party for Everybody from Russia, which sounds like your usual dance anthem, except that this dance anthem was sung by a group of elderly grandmother types dubbed the Babushkas with an average age of 72. I'm telling you, this is the senior citizen episode. They delivered both traditional singing, English language, Europop on the chorus, and even backed up some delicacies.
No, they baked up. They had an oven on stage and pretended to bake up treats to offer to everybody.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, according to you, according to Michael, it was adorable and ridiculous. The Babushkas were besieged with media requests. Their only diva-like demand was to stay in a place with running water and no stairs. The media loved them. They ate it up. No pun intended. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Eurovision is the definition of big whoop, but we have a link to the Babushkas. Check them out. It's kind of amusing. They had strong ratings around the world. The one thing that was sort of interesting that might have made it political, and you're seeing this more and more with the Olympics and racing events being held in Middle Eastern countries that have terrible human rights records. You know, this was in Azerbaijan, which has a terrible human rights records, and there were all sorts of abuses going on right before Eurovision took place. And Loreen, who is the performer for Sweden, had made some comments about human rights abuses in Azerbaijan. People were hoping that she might say something live on the air condemning them for their human rights abuses at the finale. Unfortunately, she didn't do that. That would have made it kind of a political and interesting moment. She just cried and accepted the award and started singing Euphoria again.
The only song she knew. Now, fans of British TV know to keep an eye on the BAFTA Awards. They're a good indication of which UK shows you should keep an eye out for when they air in the US. This year's winners at the UK Emmys? Appropriate Adult, a serial killer miniseries that snagged 3 top acting awards. It stars Dominic West of The Wire and The Hour, as well as Emily Watson. Top miniseries, however, went to filmmaker Shane Meadows and This Is England 88, a TV spinoff from his terrific film This Is England. Other shows to keep an eye out for include supernatural drama The Fades, about a teenager who can see dead people, because, you know, I guess the little boy from Six Degrees of...
Haley Joel Osment from Sixth Sense.
Sixth Sense, thank you. Well, you know, he grew up, and now he's starring in a miniseries. Sitcom Mrs. Brown's Baby and the Dutch drama Borgen, a hit in the international category. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. We've got a link in the show notes to the Wikipedia entry listing all the winners. Even the nominees are a good idea to keep an eye out for. It's just a great sampler of the best British television and the best television in Europe that's out there right now. So it's what I always like to look at, is to keep an eye out for what's worth watching when it comes to North America. There's so many channels and so many options of original programming now that using something like the BAFTAs to help you sift through all the possibilities and say, hey, I want to make sure I keep an eye out for Appropriate Adult. That's useful. And like This Is England, that's a terrific movie by Shane Meadows. I didn't even know he'd done these 2 TV spinoffs. He did This Is England 86, which apparently was very well reviewed as well. And now this one, which is This Is England 88, which jumps 2.5 years in the future after the last one. So I'm very excited. I had no idea this had even been happening. I'm really looking forward to seeing those movies and the original feature film all over again.
Well, I'm going to fault jet lag for not being able to remember anybody's name. But I do remember when Apple and 4 or 5 different publishers were sued by the Department of Justice for antitrust in the ebook industry, the ebook world. And that actually is our Inside Baseball story for this week. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, Michael, you probably know a little bit about this issue. Apple has finally responded to the Department of Justice regarding this antitrust lawsuit, and they were a little bit scathing when they did.
Well, they did a pretty scathing rejoinder to the document released by the Department of Justice and scored some points as far as on the facts. I think one of the big things is that the Department of Justice lawsuit talked about Apple's 30% margin as if they made a 30% profit on every book that was sold. And in fact, as Apple point out, that's completely inaccurate. They get a 30% cut of whatever price a publisher chooses to set. But then, of course, they have all their expenses. They have to maintain a website, you know, selling of the product itself, making all the ebook versions available, formatting them, all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, the 30% is not their profit margin. It's simply the cut that they get from which they draw profit, if any. And as many people have pointed out, Apple makes most of its money by selling hardware. They sell make money selling the iPads and the iPhone. They do not make a lot of their money on the iTunes Music Store or conceivably the iBook Store. Obviously very new. They're just getting into the market, competing with Amazon. But they probably don't make a huge profit on each book that's sold, certainly not 30%. So, you know, that was a factual error in the government document. And there were a number of other examples that Apple pointed out. This is the biggest one, though. They had a key paragraph. A lot of people pointed this out. And this, too, is pretty incontrovertible as far as the facts on the ground when Apple entered the ebook marketplace. Apple said in their response to the government, quote, "The government starts from the false premise that an ebooks market was characterized by, quote, robust price competition, end quote, prior to Apple's entry. This ignores a simple and incontrovertible fact. Before 2010, there was no real competition. There was only Amazon. At the time Apple entered the market, Amazon sold nearly 9 out of every 10 ebooks, and its power over price and product selection was nearly absolute. Apple's entry spurred tremendous growth in ebook titles, range and variety of authorings, sales, and improved quality of the ebook reading experience. This is evidence of a dynamic competitive market. These inconvenient facts are ignored in the complaint. Instead, the government focuses on increased prices for a handful of titles. The complaint does not allege that all ebook prices or even most ebook prices increased after Apple entered the market."
You know, the reality is, okay, so everything that Apple's saying here may be true, absolutely, but it doesn't matter because the law is the law and you're not allowed to collude to set prices. You cannot price set, even if
but
it's
this,
on...
But
on
this is Apple. Apple's, as many people point out, Apple was not really defending the publishers. They say, we have no knowledge of this. We have no, you know, we know nothing about what you're saying. But as far as our involvement, they made a very strong case for themselves that, hey, we're not involved. If the publishers got together and colluded, we knew nothing about it. We certainly didn't know anything about it. You know, the pricing model that we use, the agency model, is the same one we use over on our iTunes Music Store. So it's not unnatural for us to go to that model when going to ebooks. That's the model we used before. So why wouldn't we use that here? So they did not make a strong case that defends the publishers.
Right.
They
so
made
basically
a strong
they're
case
saying,
defending themselves. They, as others said, they threw the publishers under the bus and said, hey, we got nothing to do with them, baby.
Yeah. They basically said, hey, we're named in this lawsuit and we really don't think we should be named in it.
Right, but they also, you know, when you've got basic facts about the industry wrong, basic facts about profit margin and net profits and gross profits and all that sort of stuff wrong, it certainly doesn't help your case.
That's true. That's true. Right. Although, so, you know, the legal world is one that is constantly surprising and baffling.
That's right. Another little bit of Apple news was sort of interesting. They talked about in one part of the government's case was to quote the Steve Jobs biography. But the quotes that they pulled from that book are just hearsay as far as Apple is concerned, because they're not direct quotes of somebody. They are somebody reporting what somebody else allegedly said. And so they say, well, that's just hearsay. That shouldn't even be admissible. But Steve Jobs did come up in the news a little bit. Obviously, Pixar has the new film Brave coming out. And there's a nice little tribute to Steve Jobs when his name appears in the closing credits. There's sort of a little will-o'-the-wisp, little pixie type light flitting around the screen that lights on him and glows up his name as a little sort of gentle nod to Steve Jobs and his importance to Pixar and to Apple in general.
Well, now speaking of end credits, well, we've reached that time of the show where we do our own end credits. And you can email us. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's toll-free, 888-567-7263. Of course, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, Stitcher, your favorite podcast catcher or podcast aggregator, or via email, RSS. You know, all of that information, as well as ways to follow us on Twitter, where our username is ShowbizSandbox, or on Facebook, where our username is also ShowbizSandbox. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz said he can be found in New York, but he can also be found on his website, which is
michaelgiltz.com.
Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.